From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
This is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And today, we're going to be sharing the story of Ken Miller. He is building a company called Fathom, and it's all around bringing artificial intelligence to the podcast industry. And so you're going to need to stick around because it's a great show and you're going to learn a little bit about artificial intelligence. I learn a lot every time I talk to Ken, but today we're going to learn artificial intelligence and we're also going to learn about Fathom. Stick around, my friends.
Entrepreneurs are the heroes of the American economy. They take the risks, create the opportunities, and move the molecules. Now, back to the Marquee Media Studio, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Super excited today to be bringing on Ken Miller. He is the co-founder and CTO of Fathom, and there's other products associated with Fathom, but you guys are coming in and changing the game for podcasters and even people that listen to podcasts. So, and for our audience, you're going to meet a guy that's brilliant, right? The first time I met Ken, I was like, this guy is freaking brilliant. So welcome to the show, Ken. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Mark. Happy to be here.
Okay. Maybe just give us a little bit of background on the company and then we can kind of dive deeper from there.
For sure. Yeah. So, you know, in early 2020, I was, working in research at another startup in Trinio, primarily working in the financial space, financial data space, and playing around a lot with AI. And I was listening to a lot of podcasts at the time. And one thing I just generally noticed in the podcast space was that like transcript search really wasn't a thing. And there's a lot of reasons for that cost-wise. But I was really interested in, you know, like what would happen if we just set the cost of transcribing all the podcast episodes aside and just said, hey, let's try to transcribe a bunch of stuff and create an AI-powered search engine across these podcast transcripts, but then also incorporate some extractive AI question answering. And, you know, after a year of kind of like turning on that idea and doing research and development on the side, I had something. And so then I reached out to my co-founder, Paul Block, who's a brilliant designer, brilliant artist. And I said, Paul, I've got an AI-powered search engine for podcasts, man. What's up with it? And he's like, let's go. You know, and it was interesting. Paul and I have known each other since high school. We've worked at like three different companies together. Worked at M-Train, a company here in Sacramento. But this is the first time that we've really kind of struck out and done the whole enchilada.
That's together.
And so it's been fun.
So why do people want transcripts from podcasts? Who wants these and what kind of value do they bring? Why does it help?
Right. Well, you know, when we look at audio, right, as a medium, it's fundamentally opaque, right? So like think about when you're watching a movie, right? You can fast forward, and as you're fast forwarding, you're getting shots along the way. So you can tell what's within the content simply by fast forwarding, but with audio, you don't have that.
Okay.
Right? It's an opaque medium in
right.
that sense. So what having the transcript allows us to do is essentially lift the veil, right? And see what's within this particular content. Now, this has a lot of different use cases. From a podcaster's perspective, you know, they're going to be interested in maybe posting those transcripts for SEO purposes and whatnot. From a listener's perspective, you know, really having those transcripts within your podcast listening application really opens up the realm of search. And and that's super important, you know, when you're like looking for ideas. If you just have the audio, you know, there's no way to know what's actually within there beyond, say, like a show notes summary or a show notes description.
Okay, so let's talk about the different products that you guys have. So Fathom is one, that's what we use if we are a listener. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And so I can go on to, let's say, the Joe Rogan show, and it breaks it up into chapters and that kind of thing. Tell me how that works.
You know, Daniel Eck over at Spotify has pretty much taken that show off the.
Okay.
Yeah, out of the podcasting out of the realm. Space.
Huberman. I'm trying to think like who else.
I mean, all of these. You know, any general podcast that you listen to. Yeah, you can use the Fathom Player. It's available on iOS. It's got a lot of different features. We extract highlights from every podcast that we transcribe. So, and then we extract actually multiple highlights. And so when you follow podcasts, what you're going to get is you're going to get a feed of highlights from those episodes, but the highlights are further selected and customized for you.
Okay.
So as you're going through the feed of new episodes from stuff that you follow, you're going to get the little tidbit that's most likely to be interesting to you to help you in the selection process. How do I want to spend my time? Beyond that, we have question answering search. So you can go into the Lex Fridman podcast. You can go to the Huberman Lab podcast and ask a question. You can say, you know, how can I optimize my mental performance? And what you're going to get are you're going to get a series of clips that actually answer that question, which is really cool. We have full transcripts available that you can follow along with. To your question before, you know, what are transcripts good for? A lot of people like to actually watch the transcript as they're listening because that's going to increase retention. Okay. And then, of course, from an accessibility standpoint, right, that's huge for the deaf community. So we have full transcripts. You can follow along with those. It's really great. And we also have clipping. So as you're listening, you hear something interesting, right? You actually, boom, clip and save that. And what the AI is going to do is it's actually going to look at where you clipped, and then it's going to go backwards and actually forwards in time and try to create a clip that represents like a coherent, cohesive thought. And then it's going to save that to your library. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
And so from a, that's a direct to consumer model, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I know at one point you pivoted to a, more of a B2B, model, which we're using Podium. My man, Scott over here, right. I was asking him before the show, what do you like about it? He's like, it saves me a ton of time.
Right.
Maybe describe that product, because there's a lot of people that have podcasts now, so it's not like it's a tiny market. There's a lot of podcasters.
Yeah, I mean, just to speak to kind of like the total addressable market, there's roughly like 2.5 million podcasts out there. 400,000 of them are what they call like active, like they're very active. They're publishing monthly. So there's a tremendous amount of content, tremendous number of podcasters out there. Basically, what happened is, you know, we raised some money. We spent a couple years building the Fathom Player. But what we came to realize product-wise is that just the road to monetization for a podcast player, it's really long. It's great from a strategic standpoint, but you're really looking at like 6-8 years to gain any kind of significant market share. And with, you know, the macroeconomics being the way that they are, we decided, hey, you know, we need to bring in some revenue. Mm-hmm. So we kind of took a look at everything that we had, and we had discussed like things that we could do on the creator side anyhow. We had built a ton of AI technology to power this Fathom Player. So we basically repurposed all of that AI and created Podium. Podium launched this last February, and essentially what Podium is, it's AI tools for podcasters. The primary functionality that people use it for is, yes, to your point, to generate show notes, to chapterize your episode. So it's going to break it into segments, give you all of those timestamps, give you summaries for all of the chapters, extract your keywords, give you title suggestions, and it also extracts highlights. So the Fathom Player extracts highlights. We also extract highlights at Podium for you. So super useful for podcasters. The reception has been absolutely amazing. And yes, people love it because it saves them a tremendous amount of time.
How much, I was talking to Scott earlier, and he says that not only does it save him time, it's as good as what he could write. You know, he tweaks a wording here or there on the show notes, but pretty much great writing. I mean, it's written so that it's like ready to post.
Right. So another feature within Podium is what we call Podium GPT. So beyond all of the standard stuff that we generate by default, show notes, chapters, keyword extraction, all that jazz, we also have kind of almost a freeform chat, right? That fully understands your episode, and you can ask it, you know, write me a Twitter thread about this episode, write me a blog post, write me an email, you know, out to my newsletter audience. And it will, it fully understands the episode, so it'll then write that for you. The whole thing with with Fathom as a company is that, and you know, Paul and I, it's just kind of a vibe we're on. We like to push the limits. So I want to see how good can we make this content, right? How hard can we push this AI? And don't worry about the cost. It'll get cheaper over time, right? Let's see how accurate, how nuanced we can get this content. So we spend a tremendous amount of time really doing a lot of testing, a lot of, like, you know, sometimes I remember we'll take one episode and, like, just generating show notes. I might generate 100 versions of those show notes with different prompts, different tweaks and whatnot, and then read them all and try to arrive at, you know, a prompt for the underlying AI that really makes something that sounds nearly human.
Okay, so you actually, in your testing, you read the show, you're the guy that reads the show notes, I guess, and then you say, well, how could we make this a little more accurate, I guess, a little more engaging?
Right, so unlike some other products out there, I mean, as a team, we have fundamental AI skills. So we can build and train neural networks from scratch. So we know how all of the OpenAI, you know, GPT style models work. And what you're really doing when you're writing a prompt, like many of the people in this audience will be using ChatGPT, right? So when you're writing a prompt, you've probably noticed that, you know, if you change that prompt slightly, you can get significantly different output. And it's because when that prompt is going in as input, it's literally almost like an MRI or an fMRI. It's going to, the words that you're putting in are going to light up different portions of that neural network, right? So part of the trick when you're trying to take, say, an existing piece of content and then adapt it into another form, right? Which you can almost think of that show notes summary as a form of content adaptation, right? Mm-hmm. From the conversational transcript into adapted into a summary. You want to make sure that as that adaptation process is occurring, that you're lighting up the right portions of the neural network, right? Tonally, stylistically, right? So, but in order to do that, it really does take a lot of work and a lot of testing.
Okay, so you must be a speed reader, because I mean, if you're having, you must, I mean, this is like heavy duty. You're reading this stuff yourself. Yeah,
right.
And I mean, and having to comprehend it too.
Yeah,
and put creativity to it.
My AI background is in computational linguistics, so okay. You know, I mean, yeah, I love to read.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay, talk to us about the product roadmap. What's next? What are you most excited about?
Well, what I'm most excited about is this new product that we just released. It's absolutely fantastic. It's called Podbook. So whereas Podium today works with a singular episode, right? So you upload in your episode, you just recorded it. Everybody loves talking into these microphones, right? Super fun, super easy. Nobody likes writing. So, you know, Podium's great for that. But we started to really think, Paul and I, around what can we do with your whole library? I mean, you'll resonate with this. You know, you spend years of time investing into this content, right? Recording all these episodes, editing them. You know, what can we do not with an hour and a half of audio? What can we do with 200 hours of audio? Mm. And we thought, we can make a book.
Yeah.
You know, and so what would that look like if we took 200 hours of audio and then adapted that content into, say, a 60,000 to 90,000 word readable book? Incidentally, not super easy. But we managed to pull it off and we've put it out there. The reception has been absolutely mind-boggling. You know, the interest in it has far exceeded what we thought, you know.
And is it the same clients, the podcaster who wants to write a book? I'm a podcaster. I've been doing this thing for 5 years and man, I'm going to make a book.
Right now we're super focused on the podcast space. As a company, we do have an API. Interestingly, there's another company. We actually have startups that are building off of our startup tech.
Oh, interesting.
So one of them is called Pulpit AI. They actually recently just made Fox News. But they're geared at pastors, right? So pastors, all pastors record their sermons now, right? So you have 4 to 6 hours of audio content per church per month. They're actually connected with the Tidely guys. So, and Tidely is used in about 37,000 different churches now. So Pulpit AI is essentially an offshoot of Tidely, and they're building everything off of the Podium platform. So while we're directly targeting podcasters, there's a lot of opportunity in other audio spaces, right? Both for kind of like singular, one shot like summarization and chapterization for like, let's say a singular sermon. But what if you take 10 years worth of sermons and then produce a book out of it, right? Wow. For your congregation. So that becomes really interesting. So while, you know, as a company right now, we're kind of laser focused on the podcast space, we definitely see a tremendous amount of opportunity in other audio spaces.
Yeah, I'm thinking that pod book thing sounds really cool. And another idea came to me just as we were talking here that might be interesting for a future roadmap. And I don't know if this is possible, but Scott and I have talked about going back and there's, you know, doing like a best of, right? For like micro content. You know, we've been doing this content stuff for a long time. And a couple times I've said some really cool stuff and I want to go back and find it. What about, you know, I want to go back and find something I said that was inspirational, or maybe somebody else said was inspirational. You know, take all the episodes and find the most inspirational stuff. Or every time I talked about winning or something like that, or competitive advantage or the backyard advantage, give me the best of that. And then I would want to use that for social media, micro content.
Right. So what's funny about this, Mark, is you can actually go use the Fathom player for that functionality now. Like I can go into, the Mark Haney podcast and you can literally ask it like, what is the backyard advantage? And it's going to pull up clips across your entire library, right? But that's from a listener perspective.
Wow.
And what we found out is that search wise, maybe we were a little bit ahead of our time. Sometimes you engineer and you invent something and the market's just not ready for it, right? And when it comes to podcast search, it's something that people do, but we find that they maybe do it once every 2 weeks, once a month, not enough. But for the podcaster themselves, the content creator, that kind of search is super powerful. So we are currently working on basically incorporating all of that functionality into Podium as a product so that you can search against your entire content library using AI and also just generate clips. We have a new transcript editor that's coming out. That's actually going to be almost kind of like a simplified version of Descript. We will likely have actual like audio editing in the future, where much like Descript, you'll be able to edit the audio by editing the transcript.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So, but the ability to search across your entire content library and then repurpose clips and stuff like that into videos and audiograms, that's all coming to Podium. We're working on it currently.
So in terms of video, so like we have micro content now that it's hard to pull the audio off of that to, you know, is there anything that allows us to put like a video clip into, you know, small video clip into the system?
Right. So when we first launched Podium, it's kind of funny. It was really a market test that ended up blowing up, you know, and I feel like we've been playing catch up ever since. But we really focused a lot of our engineering effort just on the AI and it shows. But now we're actually working a lot more on the UI and To your point, yeah, audiograms is what they're typically called.
Okay.
I think Scott, you know, uses some other services like Headliner, right, in order to generate those audiograms currently. What we do provide you are like start and stop points for highlights. But what we're going to be doing is taking those start and stop points that are found by the AI for interesting highlights. And then within the Podium UI, you're actually going to be able to generate videos directly from there.
Oh, okay.
Right. So, you know, that's, I'd say that's, you know, less than 90 days out.
Wow. You build this stuff fast.
Yeah.
Are you using AI to help drive this too, right? Some of the changes and the fixes you make? I mean, what goes into that?
Right. Well, absolutely. Now, you know, I almost use GPT-4 as like, you know, my junior coder. Mm-hmm. So I'll be oftentimes, you know, writing code. And as I'm writing code, GPT-4 is writing some other piece of code I know I'm going to need in 5 minutes. So it's really, yeah, changed my workflow, you know, fairly substantially. You know, it's not perfect. It still has a way to go, in my opinion. I don't think it's going to be replacing engineers.
Yeah.
Engineers anytime soon. But it definitely, as a professional who understands what they're doing, you know, it's a, and this has been said before, you know, it's not really going to be AI is replacing your job. It's going to be somebody who's using AI to sort of 10x their productivity. Mm-hmm. That's who's going to be replacing your job if you don't kind of get on board and learn how to utilize these tools to accelerate your output.
Yeah, I'm going to circle back around to that and maybe some general
right.
AI questions. But on your company, what's the longer term vision? Where do you see this thing in, say, 3 to 5 years?
Right. You know, I mean, I think it's our positioning is really interesting, right? So if we look at the value chain for podcasting, right, it starts right here. Starts with this mic. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the first like major purchase. Anybody who becomes serious, you know, in this space, it's going to be their first major purchase. So you go from the mic and then you go into your recording software, right? Whatever software you're using to record it. From there, it's going to go into, you know, potentially an editor like Descript. Or if you're kind of cool with the way that it is, you know, you won't put it into an editor like Descript. You're just going to take the audio. Now, what's interesting about Podium is it's actually a wedged node in the value chain that's just recently emerged.
Okay.
Right. Which is before, once it's out of Descript, or if you're not going to edit it, you take it right into your host, right? You're going to upload it to your RSS host. Now you upload it to Podium first, right?
Right.
So it's like this node that, because of the advent of large language models, has suddenly appeared within the value chain. Now, as a company, we're in a really good position because we have a very, very strong foothold in that node. You know, we're really kind of the number one name now, especially after our whole Buzzsprout integration, right? Over on the player side, which is a much more difficult market to penetrate, because there we're competing with Apple, we're competing with Spotify, competing with everybody. But we have a decent foothold over there too, right? So as a company, for the longer term vision, the question becomes, okay, well, do we leverage kind of the two, you know, footholds that we have, one at the very end of the value chain, mm-hmm. right? Because it goes mic, recording, editing, hosting, player, listener, right? Into my ear. Mm-hmm. So we're at the end of the value chain there software-wise, and now we're in
kind
this
of
wedge.
Middle, yeah.
So we can compress and squeeze.
Right. You could take other pieces out of that chain.
Right. So the natural progression would be, well, you're giving us your audio before you're even giving your RSS host your audio.
Right.
So we become an RSS host.
Wow. So the opportunity just gets enormous.
Well, I theorize, you know, to a certain extent, that's why Buzzsprout made a really smart move, you know, in integrating our technology to kind of like, you know, strategically navigate the fact that there's now this new node. And, you know, potentially we could also go upstream, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that the real possibility is in sort of like squeezing and compressing the value chain. And what that may end up looking like is, you know, a merger with another company and or the merger of several companies together. Because mm-hmm. you could take a Zencastr or a StreamYard, right? Like recording software, merge it with Podium, merge it with a Buzzsprout. And then we have the Fathom Player. And now We have a completely vertically integrated solution end to end that begins to compete with the likes of Spotify. If you look at Spotify's acquisitions over the last 3 years, it's exactly the move that they're making in the
So is right now just like a race to get market share with it? Just get your thing out there. Get podium out there.
Get it integrated. Get as many podcasters as possible using Podium to accelerate, you know, the time from when they hit the stop button on, you know, to end the recording to actually them being able to publish their episode. Yeah.
You must have no churn either. I mean, once we come in, why would you stop using it? Right. It's like, unless I quit my podcast. I mean,
yeah, yeah. No, the churn's been really good. I mean, you're going to see there's actually quite a bit of churn in the podcast space. But what's interesting about it is that every year, the number of podcasts that completely disappear and drop off because somebody, you know, thinks, oh, I'm going to start a podcast.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of people
have commitment to keep
it. Does take commitment to keep it going.
It doesn't pay the bills, my friends, for me anyway.
No.
But it leads you to other opportunities.
It leads you to other opportunities. And for a lot of people, you know, it's a labor of love. It's them getting their voice out into the world. And I think that that's a beautiful thing and an important thing. But for those podcasts that do kind of drop off, they're replaced by even more people starting a podcast. So we fully expect to see some amount of churn. And that will really play out, I think, as the company matures. But that's going to be replaced by an equal or greater number of new podcasters. So when you're faced with that kind of business situation, then, you know, marketing and branding become incredibly important, right? Mm-hmm.
So right now it's just about getting market share.
Right now,
is that the biggest obstacle? Because I mean, your product is great. I mean, we're going to give you a testimonial right here. It is fantastic. It's saving all kinds of time. Okay. It's like a discovery. When I met you, it's like, oh my gosh, you're driving down the freeway, saw our sign. Oh my gosh, this guy's got a product we could use.
Well, it's super weird because now I'm speaking into this mic and the algorithms we built are going to be processing this episode. So that's a little meta. Market share. It's all about getting as much as possible. There are competitors in the space, which is another reason why I really like Podbook, because you'd have to be crazy as an engineer to try to tackle the problem, incidentally. But there's nobody doing Podbook at all. There are competitors in the like write my show notes for me space. But again, you know, we've put enough love into the AI to try to provide value to our customers to where we really have a significant advantage there and become the number one name in that space. And that shows with the fact that Buzzsprout, which is by episode publishing volume, is the number two RSS host behind Spotify. They have about 25% market share. And so the fact that they built their new co-host AI directly off of the Podium API. So co-host AI from Buzzsprout, it's all Podium behind the scenes. Basically gave us direct distribution to 400,000 podcasters. And so we kind of got all the market share there, right? And then we're, you know, also talking with several of the other RSS hosts that kind of occupy the long tail of the space.
Exciting stuff. And I met you because you were driving down Interstate 80 and you saw a venture capital sign on the side of the freeway. And you're like, this guy's crazy dude putting venture capital on the side of the freeway.
I thought it was the most interesting thing, you know, because when you're in the sort of like SF venture capital space, everything is very cappuccino, you know, and kind of coying. And I was like, somebody just straight put venture capital on a sign.
Tesla, venture capital.
Yeah. Well, what I've really appreciated, Mark, about your particular approach to marketing is I think you're very, very good at that kind of remarketing thing, even within this building. You know, it's like, I can't get your face out of my head.
Yeah.
You know, so you really are good at occupying mind share. And I think that shows with your approach there. And, hey, it worked, right?
Yeah.
I'm here. But yeah, I drove past it several times. And once I finally got tired of, you know, I think we all were working in the house during COVID. But with my three kids, it was getting increasingly difficult. And I'm like, oh, I got to get out of here and get an office. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go get an office there.
That's cool. Well, you have added a lot to the to facility. We have a co-working space here in Rockland with executive suites. And so Ken has one of those suites. And so I know people are coming up and asking you questions and bugging you and stuff like that. So sorry about that. But we appreciate you having a resident genius in the house. But let's maybe talk about, like, AI as a subject is right on the tip of everybody's tongue. You can't can't flip through the news, like CNBC I watch all the time with the financial show. AI is discussed, you know, it's about half the stories or have AI mixed in it into it somewhere. Maybe talk to us about, like, the pros and cons of AI generally, because some of that, some of the, I mean, we know it's a productivity tool, but some right people are have concerns about privacy or, you know, these other things that, you know, robots taking over the world, stuff like that. Maybe just give us a kind of a high level education.
Right. Well, you know, I'm definitely more on the optimist side. You know, I kind of look at the history of humanity, and I think just the general fact that we haven't nuked ourselves yet is a testament to, you know, the maturity of the overall, like, collective of the human organism, civilization wise. So I'm an optimist. I think that it's not gonna, you know, it's very, people love doom. We love, you know, zombie shows, right? Mm-hmm. It's a strange fascination that people have with apocalyptic events, you know? And I think what ends up happening is that's what gets airtime, right? You know, it's like when we look at the news, right?
It's a lot of negative stories.
It's a lot of negative stories. So it's like you get one positive story for every nine doom and gloom stories. Yeah. And then what you get on the AI researcher side is you'll get, you know, people in the space who are legitimate AI researchers, but maybe in their career, they haven't experienced any amount of significant popularity. And they start talking about AI doom, and then suddenly they're invited on podcasts. Everybody wants to hear what they have to say. And then what are you going to do? Are you going to back off that doomsaying position? No, because you're getting all of your flowers from it, right? So I think there's a little bit of that going on. Conversely, on the you know, kind of other hand, don't give these things guns. You know, that's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. I think that there are some minor threats in the current AI space. So when we look at something like ChatGPT, what are the threats that we face there? Well, certainly kind of like an explosion of garbage content, or not garbage content, but content that's been AI generated specifically for business purposes that don't serve any unique or distinct human value, but which successfully game, say, SEO algorithms, right, for Google. So what? You fast forward 5 years and now, you know, it's already bad enough on the internet. There's enough garbage content. But now that we can generate garbage content automatically, that kind of, you know, exponentially grows and ends up compounding and existing.
Noisy out there.
Just more noise. Now, but again, you know, in this universe, things tend to balance themselves out. So while you also, well, on one hand, you have potentially more AI generated content noise, on the other hand, AI can filter and sort that out for you, right? So so things tend to balance themselves out. I definitely think that there's some issues around training, right? And the kinds of biases that a neural network may pick up on during the training processes. So that's a definite issue. And then, you know, you can kind of try to work or mitigate the problem by working those biases out of the system, but then maybe you go too far, at least from someone's opinion, right? Mm-hmm. So what you're gonna get is with a company like OpenAI, you're going to get people who have a very particular perspective on the world, very particular perspective on politics, a very particular perspective on, you know, ethics and epistemology. And those people are all in San Francisco, and they're the ones who are training the neural network. And so you can absolutely expect, unsurprisingly, that the neural network is going to be biased to their worldview, you know? Right. So those kinds of biases are, you know, also like a potential problem. But again, it's kind of like, I don't discount human agency and people's ability to think for themselves and to judge and discriminate. So,
and we solve problems. If we create problems, we solve them.
We tend to solve them. So, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there in the AI space who are like looking at regulation of these things, but, you know, potentially, I think that's dangerous too, you know, because you can absolutely count on
stifle creativity and innovation.
Well,
slow it down.
What you're going to get is you're going to get, you know, cronyism and lock-in in Washington, I think, from that.
And maybe just maybe from an educational standpoint, what have we been using over the last several years that is, as consumers or as business people, that really has AI baked into it? Because right now, ChatGPT comes out, everybody starts using it. It's a fun, for some people, it's a fun toy. For other people, it's a productivity tool.
Right.
And then all the, you know, a lot of startups are happening because AI, but it's really new on the scene for a lot of us. But we've been using AI in different products for a while. And so maybe walk us through just some examples of what that is, and then maybe a little bit of how you envision it changing certain industries.
Right. So, well, I don't know if I'd say that we've been using AI, and actually, like, the entire term AI, artificial intelligence. What does the word intelligence even mean? I think people sometimes maybe don't pay close enough attention to words. Inner telling, right? And who are you even telling inside? I think is an interesting question. I like the term artificial cognition, right? And it really is more machine-like and cog-like, you know, in a sense. But generally, when we talk about AI, there's kind of two categories it falls into: weak AI and strong AI. And then a third category that's a major leap, which is AGI, or artificial general intelligence. Weak AI is AI, specifically neural networks, that are trained to do one specific task really, really well. That task could be anything. It could be predicting when you're going to leave your house every day, right? And through learning, it might learn, okay, you know, Mark gets up at 5 a.m. He's generally out the door at 6:15 for a run or whatever. But except for on Sundays, you know, then he's got a different routine. And so it can pick a weak AI can pick up on patterns and predict things. This is really good for things like recommendation of products and things like that.
Turn it on and off. We sold a company that turns on and off your air conditioner based upon some of those kind of habits.
There you go. Yeah. It's called weak AI, but it's still very powerful in its very limited space. What we're starting to see here with the advent of ChatGPT, and in particular large language models, is what you would call strong AI. Strong AI is has more general abilities, right? Like, you can ask ChatGPT about, you know, explain to me the fundamental nature of quantum physics. You can also ask it for, a series of recipes that involve cayenne powder and garlic powder. You know, I mean, really the potential is, quite vast there. But as far as artificial intelligence goes, as it pertains to neural networks as the underlying learning mechanism, this has only really been in play in a business productivity way, like within the engineering department, since maybe 2015. We've actually been using machine learning for a very long time, since the early 2000s, right? But there were a different series of learning algorithms for machines that we would use because it took too much compute to actually model a neural network. But what they came to discover, incidentally, is that just like perhaps nature and sort of like the evolution of organisms on this planet came to discover, is that neural networks as a fundamental mechanism for predicting the future is actually the most flexible and efficient way to go about it. So if you have enough compute, now everything is neural networks, right? We don't use or we tend not to use some of those older machine learning algorithms. But the general idea of statistical machine learning has been in play, I mean, since, you know, the early 2000s, really, for product recommendations, Amazon, right, Netflix, and a variety of other use cases. I think what really ended up happening from a, like, kind of industry insider standpoint is in 2017, there was this paper published called All You Need Is Attention. And that was literally the title of the paper. And the researchers who wrote it basically dug up, because neural networks have been around since the 70s, but it just took too much compute in order to do anything really, truly interesting with it. This idea of baking attentional mechanisms into neural networks mathematically, it's been around since like the mid 80s or early 90s. But again, not enough compute to do anything with it. So some researchers dug up that old research and said, hey, what if we took these attentional mechanisms, made a few changes? Now we have enough compute, right? Mm-hmm. And they published this paper, Attention Is All You Need, and it was the key. So the performance on various tasks, like the identification of objects and images, the ability to like summarize text, the ability to extract an answer from text, the performance scores went up through the roof as soon as you baked in these attentional mechanisms. So it was really at that moment in time in late 2017 when that paper was published that kind of sparked this whole revolution that now we're sitting in 6 years later.
Yeah. Well, so thinking about some of the industries, I'm in the security industry, so facial recognition is right. Is big. Yeah, I just saw, you know, self-driving cars is, our cars are self-driving at some level now. We're invested into a number of companies that are using AI
right.
at some level to even solve disease and things like that. So maybe paint a picture. And it's changing so fast now because AI, I mean, it has come upon us faster than anything I've seen in my life, faster than mobile, faster than when computers hit the, when computers and mobile and social media and all these different trends, turning points.
Right.
They all happen pretty fast, but this has happened faster.
Intelligence is a great product, yeah. You know, any way it goes. I think there's a lot of factors involved there, right? So one of the interesting things about AI that's different than any other product is that AI helps make better AI. So I think to a certain extent, some of that exponential or compound growth that we're all feeling, which can be a little bit anxiety inducing for people, you know, is part of that is that, you know, once you have intelligence as a product or cognition mm-hmm. as a product, you know, that's going to assist you in making further advances. So whereas a car, I mean, in that even like, you know, potentially applies to something like a car, you know, I'm sure once the first cars came out and we're rolling off the line, it's like, oh, well now we don't have to use horses. We can actually get parts to the factory faster. We're going to use cars to make cars, right?
Yeah.
So all technology has a bit of that kind of, potential for compound, advancement baked into it. But intelligence itself as a product, it's kind of like, you know, that's the mountain peak there. And then beyond that, what's also happened is you have every math major on the planet now is doing AI research. It really is just a lot of, you know, statistics and probability theory and all of the other various branches of math kind of all smashed together. And so that's really been contributing to, like, if you look at the research papers that are published out of both private and public institutions and you look at the number, it is an exponential curve. So that's really what's kind of like powering a lot of these advancements. But you never know when you're going to hit a wall. And I actually think like GPT-4, until some other major, major leap is made, GPT-4 has actually hit a wall.
Okay.
In fact, it was kind of leaked just about a week ago. Because they've been very hush-hush about what the underlying architecture is, despite their name OpenAI. But it was leaked the fundamental architecture. And they're using this thing called mix of experts. So GPT-4 is actually, I think it's five neural networks that are 220 billion parameters, just slightly, actually considerably larger than GPT-3. But everybody thought, oh, this is going to be like a 500 trillion parameter model. It's going to be massive and massively forward. Now, it's really, they have five different models, but each model is trained on a different subset of data. And so they feed it through all five, and then they use the output from the model that's most confident. It's called mix of experts. The thing is, mix of experts, that kind of model architecture is what you do when you're out of ideas.
So OpenAI is what we're talking about. Right. Now, it's got competitors.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. When you say kind of, what you're saying, it doesn't really have competitors?
Well, you know,
is there going to be one big winner?
It's really interesting, Mark, like the way that the space has shaped up. There was this paper leaked again from Google where one of the researchers was basically saying, we have no moat. You know, the open source large language models are advancing so quick. You know, and OpenAI doesn't have any moat either, right? Like the open source research community is going to surpass the ability of any private institution. But what's interesting is that in the graphs where they were showing the performance of the open source models versus something like the original ChatGPT, the performance analysis was coming from GPT-4's opinion of how well the things. So I'm like, come on, guys. Like, are you just blind to this? Clearly, they have a moat if you're using their highest end neural network to even judge the performance of everybody else's, right? So, yeah, you know, I think that Google has been a little bit late to the game. And I mean, for obvious reasons, they're already making a tremendous amount of money. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a whole lot of incentive for them to, and until they have some kind of
Google search.
Right. Until they have some kind of fundamentally existential threat. And as soon as Microsoft came in and integrated ChatGPT into Bing, that existential threat came to bear. And so now you've got Palm, you've got some of these other things, but there really is nothing out there that competes with the competence of GPT-4. Although Google DeepMind,
What about Amazon? Yeah. Do they have something on the horizon?
Yeah, Amazon's working on a new offering called Bedrock. They're closely integrated with another company called Anthropic. Anthropic's got some great models. Again, not quite GPT-4 level, but some decent models for lower end tasks.
How about Meta? Are they in the game?
Yeah, so Meta released a model called Llama. And actually, it was just a research model, but it got leaked. All these things, they end up getting leaked, right? So it got leaked. And actually, what's crazy is Meta's Llama model actually sparked the entire open source LLM revolution. When that thing was leaked, the kind of people in the open source space now had a massive, what we call foundational model to begin working from. And so the open source community began applying a lot of different AI training techniques to it. And next thing you know, you have their model, which was kind of, it was okay, but it wasn't great. But after the open source community got a hold of it, now you have other, models that are in a similar fashion named after camel-like creatures like vicuna and stuff like that. You know, everybody's funny, right? That are performing at GPT 3.5 levels, like standard GPT 3 levels. So yeah, Meta's in the game, Amazon's in the game, Google is in the game.
The lion's share is going to GPT-4 right now. That's where the guys like you, the players, the guys that know what they're doing in a big way, they're mostly on GPT-4.
Well, it's you know, it's the best. There are no other models that offer its level of cognitive capabilities, not merely as like, say, a summarization engine, but also just as a reasoning engine, right? So GPT-4 is able to reason out solutions to problems. And in fact, you know, some of the other growth factory portfolio companies like 4PM, mm-hmm. right, that has recently come out. They're really leveraging those reasoning engine capabilities of GPT-4, where they're essentially taking a conversation and then reasoning which portions of those conversations map to fields in a CRM that takes reasoning capability. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting one. We'll probably talk more about that one, but yeah, it's basically bolting on or working with a, you know, a Salesforce or, you know, a HubSpot or something like that, and making the job of the sales rep a lot easier. And, you know, it's interesting, just a little way, not little, that's a big way that could transform a Salesforce.
I like to say every single piece of software at this point is going to be rewritten.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so I'm going to circle back around to something you touched on at the beginning of the show, and that was jobs, right? Job displacement, but yet job creation. You got all these math wizards that are going to have new types of jobs, and there are other jobs getting created out of AI or this technology. And there are going to be some people that, you know, some jobs that just aren't needed as much, that kind of some of those redundant jobs. How do you see that shaking out?
You know, I don't think it's any different, Mark, than any other technological advancement. Okay. You don't see too many blacksmiths walking around, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure that if you go back in the history books, there were probably blacksmiths saying you can't trust the strength of the metal coming out of the, you know, the machines that are machining the metal. You can't trust it.
Right,
it hasn't been hammered on by me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but did advancements in, you know, manufacturing and milling and whatnot, did those create less jobs or more jobs? Ultimately created more jobs. Even, you know, but the jobs shift, they change. Humans are incredibly adaptable, beautiful organisms. You know, there's lots of different things that we can do, and we will always find creative ways to occupy our time. Is it going to hurt a little bit? Yeah. And I think that we need to be, you know, compassionate in that way. I think that, you know, I'm even less worried about some of the white collar impacts that, you know, GPT or any of the large language models really potentially represent. I'm really more interested in like, you know, big rig truck drivers. Mm. You know, that's like one of the number one jobs, highest paying jobs. You know, a job where you can really support your family, but doesn't require a, you know, a tremendous amount of formal education, a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm.
If you don't need that guy because the truck drives itself.
The truck, it will drive itself. Trust me, before 2030, the truck, I mean, we already have the tech. It just needs a bit more refinement. It will absolutely get there. I'd say it's even behind where I thought it was going to be by about 5 years. It's going to get there, and then it is cheaper. So you will have that, you know, labor force displaced essentially. And that needs to be thought through, you know, as a society. But again, you're not going to stop it.
Yeah.
It's you can't stop it. So.
Well, I think it's going to allow maybe the truck driver to do something that uses a little bit more imagination, right? So how could he help the trucking industry in a different way, or the transportation industry in a different way, instead of, you know, sitting behind the wheel of a vehicle? He could do something more productive and interesting for himself or herself.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I think that there's lots of people who have put that viewpoint out there. But I think if we're really being honest with ourselves, you have a 43-year-old, 45-year-old truck driver, maybe even a 50-year-old truck driver, been driving truck for 15, 20 years, whatever. Maybe they change careers. It pays well, right? Hard work breaks the body. And then you take that away because now the trucks drive themselves. I don't think it's going to be like, oh yeah, you know, go write poetry now. You know, it's like,
yeah,
that person's life is going to be fundamentally disrupted. Now the next generation's not going to have that problem because they're never going to get into truck driving, but you're going to have 20 years of
be a little
of,
bit of pain or adjustment,
people suffering, you know? And so I think if you want to look at like what the real danger for AI is, it's that kind of job displacement. I think it's a lot easier for people in the white collar space to make that kind of creative shift than it is for people in the manual labor.
It's interesting.
Space.
So I own a concrete company, right. And it's not going to pour the concrete for us, right? So we have trouble getting enough labor, to do all the work, right? Where there's more demand out there than we have the resources to. Right. To finish the concrete and so on, because it's very, you're pushing wheelbarrows around and, it's manual labor. How's it going to affect the trades? How is AI going to affect, other than make us plan better and, a lot of the behind the scenes stuff will happen a lot faster, but in terms of swinging a hammer or, finishing concrete, do you see any way that it can affect that stuff?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I didn't realize you owned a concrete. Concrete's such a fascinating it's the most produced man-made substance, that every other man-made substance, plastics, everything, if you add all of them up by weight, we make more concrete. It's crazy. So GPT is not going to pour your concrete for you. However, there will be a robot that will pour your concrete for you, and you'll be able to give it orders and talk to it because
that's
of GPT-like
fantastic
technology. Right. So, yeah, I think, but to get there, I mean, we greatly underestimate this thing. This human body is a masterwork. And to get a robot to be anywhere near as energy efficient or dexterous as the human body, we are a long way. We are a far cry from that. And but I think you will get in the next 30 to 50 years, you will have robots that replace a lot of manual labor. But whether or not they're gonna, I mean, what's interesting is that in the past, when it's come to robotics, it's all been about almost like a Henry Ford like assembly line type automation of a repetitive task that can be done with precision every single time, like that singular spot weld from a robot arm. Mm-hmm. It can go in the same place, and then you have error tolerances. For some of the stuff that's more manual labor, you do need, when you're working out in nature, and you need to have that human body or that kind of like dexterous thing. So I think there's a question as to when robotics will get to that point to where, say, like an iron worker might be displaced by a robot. I think we're probably about 20, 30, potentially even 50 years out from that.
Okay. But we are using robots. A couple of portfolio companies at the Growth Factory. One inspects solar farms. Another one is a drone that inspects airports and, stuff like that. So it's coming. We're moving in that direction.
It's coming. It's when you have to grab something. Mm. It's the grabbing of something, The human hand is
I'm invested
tool.
Into a strawberry picker type company that's a robotic, and it's like a hand.
Again, it's one of those things where yes, it can pick strawberries, but can it pick watermelons? Right? And so that's the thing, is that you might get a robot where, because of the fundamental shape of the form in material reality, you're able to create a robot that handles that singular task, but can the fundamental mechanical mechanisms of that bot being then generalized to other things? Whereas you can take someone who picks strawberries, and I guarantee you they're going to pick apples almost equally as well.
Okay, let me give you the last word here. We're about out of time, but I want to make sure if there's anything I didn't ask you, or you want to make sure that our audience has a perspective on, maybe I'll just give you the last word here.
Yeah, I would say for everybody out there who's kind of, maybe feels nervous about like the advent of AI, or is looking at all of like the doom saying, I'll go back to, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Stay optimistic, and really consider the ways in your life that you may be able to use these tools creatively to, enhance your life and enhance your productivity. And, you know, don't pay too much attention to everybody who thinks it's all going to fall apart because of AI. I mean, I don't know anything. I know a thing or two, but I have a strong feeling that what we're going to see in the next 20 to 50 years is actually a, you know, increased flourishing for humanity, new inventions, new ways to solve problems that previous generations have, you know, somewhat naively or unknowingly created through their use of technology. So I'm an optimist about everything, and I think there's some great things coming down the road.
Ken Miller, thank you for the education. Appreciate you being a part of the Groove Factory and what we're doing around here on Granite Drive. And I look forward to learning more from you as over the years to come.
For sure. Thanks for having me, Mark.
I bet.
Now, let's get Mark's perspective and closing thoughts from today's show. We're back to the Marquee Media Studio. It's the Mark Haney Show.
Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. Thank you, Ken Miller. So proud to have you as a member of the Growth Factory, as a person that shares office space with me. And it's great to have your innovative mind in my world. It's great to have a friend like you. So shout out to you, Ken Miller, and to all you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship. We're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.